She was a girl at a potter's wheel, furiously spinning cups and bowls and plates for a father who would never drink out of them, never eat off them, but would occasionally stuff a clump of pencils in one of the mugs or shove one of the plates to the back of his desk. Eventually, Susanna stopped the pottery altogether, said it was too time-consuming, though by that point she'd quit Stengel, Mathers, and Broad and was home with her boys, my adorable grandchildren, Ethan and Daniel, all day. Alice had never really tried to win Joe over in the ways that her sister had. It was as though she'd sized him up early on and realized it was impossible to capture the heart of such an egotist. Other women like Alice were charmed by her. She looked good in a bracing, freshly laundered way. As an adult, she tolerated Joe, gave him hard, affectionate hugs, and was slightly more loving to me. Pam, who she lived with now in Colorado, was perplexing to me as a life choice for Alice because she seemed so literal. She was pretty in a flattened and poreless way. Her eyes were small and light. She practiced Pilates, and her cooking was superb, if you could open yourself to the wonders of all the different members of the root vegetable family. But, of course, I really did understand what Alice got from this marriage. Pam was the wife, and that was what my daughter wanted, perhaps without even knowing it. Both our daughters were home with their families right now, one with real longing and regret, wishing she could be here with us, with him. The other not really caring all that much. David, of course, didn't offer to come. He almost never went anywhere, but kept to a simple path each day like a monorail. His neighborhood coffee shop, a used comic book store, a Chinese takeout place, his job, and then home again. He had no curiosity about this trip we were on. He'd asked nothing, offered no congratulations, made no inquiries. While Joe and I traveled the length of a hotel lobby in Finland, David was in his basement apartment reading one of those graphic novels he loved, with their pen and ink depictions of a bleak, futuristic future. He'd have a white carton of Chinese food open on his lap, depositing noodles everywhere. I saw him filling himself up with the oily takeout food and reading about fantastical lives and hidden post-apocalyptic worlds, and occasionally confronting a strand of memory about a life that he hadn't lived in a long time. Childhood. I walked beside Joe now, our bodies moving together through space, neither of us looking at the other. No pure tenderness existed here. Whatever we had was threaded with familiarity. As we headed with the bellman toward a bank of dimpled glass elevators that led to a private VIP floor, I noticed a young woman glancing at Joe with an expression of interest. She appeared nervous and tentative as she stepped forward and blurted something out in his direction.
"Mr. Joseph Castleman, you are a wonderful writer," she said. "My felicitations to you."
She wasn't beautiful, exactly, though she wore an expression of Scandinavian grace. Her hair was the color of a manila envelope.
"Thank you," said Joe, smiling and stopping briefly. "That's very kind."
He extended a hand and she shook it. Her hand held on, clutching his for just a little too long. Vaguely it occurred to me that she might be a stalker. But then I remembered that I had never heard of a Finnish stalker. Stalkers often seemed to come from the Midwest, though occasionally they rose up like swamp creatures from the wetlands of Florida. Over the years, Joe had received letters from some of them, and though the men tended to be more overtly threatening, it was the women he feared most. Men were so obvious with their hostility, and if you were in danger, you'd know it. Joe had been in danger more than once, and the person who had been most hostile to him was our son. David wasn't insane, he wasn't psychotic, only marginal, only borderline. Those catchwords for all unpredictable outsiders. And David was fragile, which meant that it was easy to knock him over, to make him lose his way.
The night that David threatened Joe, I wasn't home. Instead, I was out at Lois Ackerman's house for a meeting of my long-standing women's book group, which that month was reading The Golden Bowl. Joe and David were alone in the house together. It was a freezing night in upstate New York. David, in his 20s at the time, was staying in our house because his apartment had flooded and he had nowhere else to go. To say that he was a stellar child at the beginning is to make light of his intellect, the somber way he approached everything, big or small. When he was born, Joe had been thrilled to be the father of a boy at last. A boy would save the day, would give back something of what Joe had lost when his own father had dropped dead so long ago, changing the future. Joe often turned his attention to David in a way I'd never seen him do with the girls. They went fishing together. They played pool. They hiked Mount Cardigan in New Hampshire in heavy boots, carrying knapsacks I'd stuffed with foods they liked. Most of these activities were done in the presence of other men, usually writers. Joe rarely took David off alone. What would they have talked about hour after hour? As a boy, David liked to pummel you with questions one after the other, like one of those fact-crammed children's books. Do insects have eyelids? How come you can't tickle yourself? Why are people interested in the smell of their own farts? Joe became weary quickly, and when he returned from an outing, he would hand David off to me and disappear for hours. I'd go and visit with David in his room, sit on the side of the bed as he removed his muddy boots. Did you guys have fun? I'd ask, touching his head. One day I knew I wouldn't be able to touch his head. One day he would flinch as though my hand were burning hot. So I'd better do all the touching I could while he was still young. He tolerated my touches, but never basked in them the way the girls did. This was a boy thing, I decided, a necessary part of manhood. He just sat there patiently, waiting until I'd finished. Like Joe, David was handsome, dark, big-headed with black curls. Joe was thrilled by our son's intellect, by the fact that the school had said he was a genius. When David was little, Joe often took him to bars, though I didn't know it at the time, and our little boy played with his Hot Wheels cars in the sawdust at his father's feet. Other famous writers and groupie types reached down and absently ruffled David's hair. He barely seemed to register their touch, or, if he did, he never felt it as affection, and he was rarely affectionate back. He lived in our midst. He did his schoolwork with alarming speed, making very few mistakes. And he went off on hiking trips with Joe and Joe's friends. But there was no real warmth emanating from him. His sisters had always been puppyish, wanting to please, confiding in me about friends and working for hours on Valentine's Day cards for their father. But David was cooler, more remote, less rewarding. A psychiatrist we consulted long ago told us we were making something out of nothing. He's a brilliant boy, the man said, for apparently he'd never tested a child who scored as high as David, and the Selinger's Glass family level of his IQ simply canceled out any possibility of his being defective. He wasn't autistic, like the son of a poet we knew who walked around repeating fragments of phrases from TV commercials.
"Rice-a-roni, the San Francisco treat,"
that boy would sing, his voice high and ethereal. David was extraordinary, we were told by everyone, and we should just leave him alone. Joe in particular was insisted that we give David enough latitude, as he put it, imagining, I suppose, that David would use all that space to invent, to cure, to compose, to dream. But instead, he kicked another kid at school in the groin and he upturned a cafeteria table. And once he taunted a teacher, saying she had a mustache like Hitler and that no man would ever love her. She feared it was true and called in sick every day for a week. Off to a residential school for troubled but intelligent kids. One of those places with beanbag chairs everywhere and circle time and a full staff of therapists. David kept to himself, then graduated first in his class and miraculously was accepted to Wesleyan,
thanks to some string-pulling and heavy bartering on Joe's part. But David lasted less than 4 semesters. In New York City over sophomore spring break, he threatened a man with a box cutter in an East Village bar and wound up in jail. When we went to see him, talking to him from the other side of a plexiglass wall, David was agitated and restless, mortified to be confronted in prison by his parents. Joe kept asking how in the world David could have done this, and David understood that the subtext was, "How could you have done this to me?" "How could I do this?" David said. "What kind of a question is that?" "It's a reasonable question," Joe said, "so answer it." "We're concerned," I added. "I know you're concerned, Mom," David said finally, addressing me only, as if Joe weren't there. "I fucked up, okay? I have anger issues."
"Issues?" said Joe acidly.
"Yeah, issues," said David.
"You don't just have issues. You have a whole subscription," said Joe.
David turned and walked away, facing the corner. And it wasn't until we got him out of there that he spoke to us again. We took him back to our house that night, and he said very little over the next few days. We tried to talk about the legal situation, but he appeared mostly uninterested. When we drove him back to Middleton, Connecticut, David was eager for us to go. "Okay," he said, after we came inside with him. "Well, thanks for the ride. Do you need anything? Because I really should get back to things." We didn't know it yet, but he would quit school abruptly, permanently, a few weeks later, without explanation. That night, he wanted us to leave right away and not bother him. He was dismissing us. I was briefly insulted, but I got over it. Joe didn't. He stood in his coat with his hands jammed into his pockets, and when we did leave a few minutes later, David hugged me, surprising me by the sudden gesture. Joe, he simply nodded, too. He didn't like his father, and maybe never had. But now the shape of the dislike seemed to be changing. I didn't pick up on the extent of it, and neither did Joe. Over the years, David, after he left school and moved to New York, got into occasional bar fights and confrontations with women. He would describe these scenes to me in mortified detail, as though talking about someone else entirely. He never spoke specifically about his anger at Joe. I knew that sons often raged at their father. I'd read Arthur Miller and the usual body of Greek drama. I could picture the classic distant towering father and the son with the primal unmet needs. I could imagine the passage of years and the slow freeze on the part of the son, met eventually by the slow thaw of the father, by which point it's far too late. Damage has been done and the son turns away saying, "Sorry, Pop," and leaves the old man hunched and weeping in his Barca lounger. But I never really saw any of that in our family. For a long time, David and Joe stayed at a certain level of uneasy mutual dislike, maybe contempt. But finally it was ratcheted up much higher. This was the night that David's apartment became flooded, the entire place suddenly ankle-deep in murky New York water. His books and newspapers were sent floating, and because he had nowhere else to go, I insisted he come stay with us. "It's just for a while," I said. And so he came. At first, the living situation went surprisingly well. The house in Wethermill is big, and David kept to himself except during meals, fixing himself fried egg sandwiches for snacks and then going out for the night, visiting the local bars to drink and shoot pool. Old high school friends who still lived in the area would call. Friends who worked at the Rexall drugstore or for their father's exterminating business. Their voices low and hangdog on the telephone. Who were they, really? Pornographers? Drug dealers? I had no idea. My son's world was closed to me. The night David turned on Joe seemed peaceful enough at the start. We had dinner together, the three of us. Joe and I did most of the talking while David offered a few monosyllables between forkfuls of steak. Nothing seemed unusual to me. When I went off to Lois Ackerman's house for my book group, I remember feeling grateful to be going, to have a reason to get out. David was oppressive. It was a sad thing when you wanted to be away from your son, but it wasn't a tragedy. After the drive along winding roads, when I sat down in Lois's living room, surrounded by these kind and intelligent women who shared a common interest in closely reading the books we'd forgotten all about since college, I wished I could stay there, move into Lois's spare room. She was divorced and clearly lonely. When she kissed everyone hello, she hugged too hard, lingered too long. She was tall, lantern-jawed, dressing in heavy turquoise jewelry she'd acquired on her solo trips to the Southwest. Lois was always solo. Her isolation was painful to her, yet very appealing at times to me. Her house seemed to be an oasis, the big bed covered in a pristine duvet, the night table with its box of French caramels, bottle of Nivea lotion, and pile of old Merchant Ivory videos. The place was man-free, quiet. Right now it chimed with the sounds of women's voices. Individual words and phrases rose up from the conversation. Modernity. Narrative structure. Princess Casamassima. The food was good, too. The coffee table strewn with dips and small marinated things. I was relaxed, drinking and eating and joining in the spiraling discussion of betrayal within a marriage. I didn't know if it was paranoia, but it seemed as though, whenever I made a comment, everyone listened more keenly because they knew I had first-hand knowledge of betrayal. Still, I wasn't feeling particularly betrayed at that moment. And Joe, meanwhile, was sitting in our living room at home with a swirling, clinking bourbon, appreciatively listening to Herbie Hancock on the new Bose sound system he'd just bought. The men who own the world are obsessed with sound systems. Don't ask me why. He was nested in his maroon chair, reading the paper and drinking and listening. David was upstairs in our house, burrowing in his childhood bedroom. I thought the evening would go on like that. I thought everyone was doing what they ought to be doing. Then the telephone rang at Lois's. She answered, then came and got me. "It's Joe," she mouthed silently, as Sylvia Brumman continued an overexcited, stuttering comparison of early versus late Henry James. I picked up the telephone in Lois's kitchen and spoke, alarmed to hear Joe's strained voice saying, "Hello, Joan? Sorry to disturb you, but things are a bit difficult here at the moment." "What does that mean?" I asked. "David," he said. "David, what's the matter?" "Yes, he's right here," said Joe. "You can't talk," I said. "No," he said. "I can't, but maybe you should come home. I could use you here." And then Lois popped her head into the kitchen to make sure everything was okay, which, of course, it wasn't. I made my excuses, then left immediately and roared home. One thing led to another, and that night I convinced David to let me drive him to a small psychiatric hospital in Westchester for an evaluation. He ended up staying there for 2 weeks, sleeping a lot, adjusting to the antidepressant medication they'd put him on. When a couple of the women from my book group called me to find out what had happened, I vaguely told them there had been a scene between Joe and David, and I left it at that. I didn't want to discuss it. No one asked for details. They knew I had a troubled son and how painful that was to me. Though David still takes medication, or at least he's supposed to, he's never had to be hospitalized again. For the past couple of years, he's managed to keep working at the same law firm, appearing there late at night, often looking ragged, but his typing skills are intact. There have still been occasional fights, dust-ups, nothing too serious. The tension between David and Joe never really went away, though I guess we all grew used to it. But potential violence came from elsewhere, too, not just from our son, making Joe wonder what it was about him that charged people up. Once Joe had received a letter that began, "Dear Mr. Castleman, you think you are God's gift, don't you? Well, I am just a loser. but I am writing my own novel, and you'd better watch your ass, Castleman, for you're in this book, too, and your character doesn't live to see how it ends. Joe had called the police in on that letter. I'd urged him to. And when the two Wethermill patrolmen arrived that night, he'd felt some embarrassment, for the more he considered it, the less he could believe that someone would actually kill a novelist. A non-fiction writer, maybe, though even that seemed to defy credibility. What was the point of killing a writer? Politicians, actors, former Beatles, those he could in some way understand, for they had tangible power in the world and could actually do things. But a novelist? Joe feared the psychotic ones and had mild contempt for the legions of readers who conducted online discussion forums about his writing, who painstakingly sought out everything he'd ever published, who needed to find new ways to keep him close to them. When they confronted him in person, he hung back shyly, a little bit frightened and irritated by the intrusion, but flattered, always flattered, his eyes taking on a certain wet shine of vanity. But when the fan was young and beautiful, he'd lift his head and frankly stare into her eyes, leaning forward slightly, stepping inside the outer edge of the circle of perfume she invariably cast. It was the most obvious thing in the world, the way he moved toward pretty women, wanting them so much, speaking in a low voice that tenderized the warm skin of their necks. In the beginning, all those decades ago, I would often look away when this happened, would go get another glass of reception wine, chat with the provost if we were at a college, or Joe's introducer, or the publicist. I'd turn my back on the seduction that was taking place only a few yards away from me. Then, sometimes, I fought him. I chastised him, and he told me I was making things up, or else he caved in and apologized, saying that he knew how weak he was and he hated it. But as time passed and his behavior didn't change, I simply turned away again whenever it happened. I drank from my little plastic glass. I swooped a celery stick through a pool of dip, knowing that behind me, my husband was becoming acquainted with a young, beautiful girl, a faithful reader. She might be saying to him, "You know the part in Overtime that begins with the daughter washing her hair? That is the most beautiful description of female adolescence I've ever read. How do you know such things, Mr. Castleman?" And he would shrug and thank her. Sometimes, days later, through means I never really knew, they would find each other again. The charming young woman who faced him in the lobby of Helsinki's Intercontinental Hotel was probably a brainy Finnish girl from a provincial background who wanted to hold a Helsinki laureate's hand for just a moment too long, and she was still smiling at him as he walked away from her and over to the elevator. "Lucky you. They love you everywhere," I whispered, as one of the bellmen inserted a key in a lock on a panel, and the glass cage rose with the lovely cushioned swoosh that could only be found in European lifts. "I don't think that woman loves me," Joe whispered back. "You're exaggerating." "Oh, I would put a little money on it," I said. "Someone has to love me," he said. "As far as I can tell, the job is currently unoccupied." The bellman, standing by, gave no indication that he understood this cryptic marital sparring. The elevator rose and rose with its hum of cable and hint of fjord, letting us off at the silent, pristine VIP floor. In the distance, a maid scurried off. A wide oak door was swung open, and we were invited into the presidential suite. Enormous windows overlooked the cobblestones and the trees below. "What?" the bowman said proudly in one of the bathrooms, yanking a brass tap in the veined marble sink. "Colt," he said, turning the other one. There was a formal dining room in the suite as well as two bedrooms, a living room, a small library, and a sauna. The master bedroom held an enormous white bed with tall posts, and two thick robes were laid across it. Dazed from the effects of air travel and a surfeit of attention, and by all the splendor, Joe pulled off his clothes piece by piece and shrugged into one of the robes. I don't know what we're supposed to do next, he told me. You know what we do? We sleep. He nodded, sat on the bed testing the give of the mattress, and then he yawned ostentatiously. Are you sure it's a good idea? He asked me. Shouldn't we wait until the evening? Shouldn't we force ourselves to stay awake so that we can start to get on their timetable? Anyway, I don't think I could sleep, he said. You know I never do. Today you will, I said. I bet you're more tired than you've ever been in your life. That's true, he admitted. So we stripped and crawled under the deep white waves of blankets. We ignored each other's body. We were indifferent, like we'd usually been in recent years. Except my indifference was mixed with hostility, which Joe tried not to notice right now. Loveless, we lay together. Elsewhere in the suite, hidden doors were opened and closed by meek and ghostly maids. Fruit was silently polished and arranged in baskets, and the ends of toilet paper rolls were fashioned into origami. Then, eventually, the distant collections of sounds stopped, and Joe and I lay in silence, our skin a perfect temperature against high thread count sheets. Joe appeared small beside me in the bed. Bits of white chest hair frothed up over the edge of the blanket, and his nipples were exposed, those vestigial discs. He was frail and exhausted, but contented, and uncharacteristically, for the first time in a very long while, he slept. We both did. Voices awakened us eventually, an angel choir pulling us slowly from the unnatural sleep of travelers, and when we opened our eyes, it was already late morning of the next day. And we were shocked to find our bright hotel bedroom filled with strangers, young girls dressed in white and carrying candles, singing their hearts out, all of it in Finnish. This was a Helsinki Prize rite of passage, someone at dinner later explained to us, a shameless copy of a similar Swedish display put on for winners of the Nobel Prize, and while we lay there, dopey and sandy-eyed from sleep, photographers appeared at the edges of the room to document the spectacle. As they did, the candle holders stepped back, and the plate carriers stepped forward, girls bearing fruit and cheese and sugar-dusted pastries. And then they too stepped back, and forward came two girls carrying huge cups of coffee. Bowls, they were, the kind that kittens lap at. And then the food and drink and candles were placed on silver trays at the foot of our bed. How long is this going to go on? Joe whispered to me, but I shushed him and smiled at the girls, and he knew enough to follow my example. On cue, all the pretty girls joined hands, raised their delicate arms and sang to us in voices that would have stirred the most frozen heart that ever beat. I didn't know what the words meant. Presumably they had something to do with the glory of the day and the greatness of the celebration, though I suppose that just as easily for their own fun they might have been singing, "Fuck you, Joe Castleman, the overrated writer we despise. Fuck you, American upstart, who hath come and claimed our prize." Once upon a time there had been another hotel room, a very different one in New York City. It was small and wretched, and no angel girls sang to us in the morning. This was 45 years earlier. But even after all this time, I could visualize its shape and smell and its vague implied filth. Joe and I had headed there first on the bus as we fled Northampton together, and then on a New York City subway train with its yellow woven seats and concave wall ads for Dreft laundry detergent and chiclets. I was 19, hanging by a strap. In the middle of my forehead was the ludicrous purple goose egg that had been left when Joe's wife, Carol, had flung the walnut at me 2 days earlier. As I held on to the subway strap like an ordinary commuter, I saw Joe watching me, taking in the lump on the forehead and also the hollow of my underarm, that scooped-out place inside my creased yellow dress. I'd only brought a weekend's worth of clothes with me. The rest would be sent down in a steamer trunk from Smith later. Here I was on the subway, which I'd almost never been on in my life, though I knew every stop on the crosstown bus, which I used to ride with friends after school most days. I was terrified to call my parents and confess to them what I'd done, though I assumed that the college would have the privilege of doing just that. They were right here in the city, and though it was possible that I might actually run into them, it didn't seem likely. They never went on the subway, or had reason to visit the part of the city where Joe was taking me. Their route was predictable and short, involving Park, Madison, and Lexington Avenues, and not much else. Of course, I could have used their help, for Joe and I had very little money. But I somehow knew that I shouldn't take their money now. This part of my life had nothing to do with them, and I didn't want to bring them into it. At least not yet. I was with Joe now, and so I acted like a good sport, the willing undergraduate who'd thrust myself out of the gates of Smith College and gone off to New York with my professor, though I suspected the mood wouldn't last. And it didn't, of course. When Joe and I walked into the small greenish lobby of the Waverly Arms, where the night clerk sat behind a barred window, I was appalled at what I found there, and I stood in pinched schoolmarm silence while Joe signed the register. Room 402 was worse than the lobby. It, too, was greenish and had a window with so many dead flies trapped between the panes that they seemed to have been intentionally pressed there by a naturalist. The room gave off intimations of its unsavory history, convincing you that a particular type of soup had once been cooked there on the hot plate, Scotch broth, and that another time, someone had lain in a stupor of illness on the concave mattress of the bed. "This is disgusting," I said, sitting on the edge of that bed and starting to cry. Joe had thought I would be able to overlook the hotel's essential decrepitude because it was located in Greenwich Village. He'd hoped I would rise to the siren song of the village, to the sounds of men dreamily practicing the horn, or just the way the people looked, dressing with a kind of defiant, jobless freedom. He'd hoped I would glance around and say, "This is what I want." But it was impossible to take a Smith girl with no experience of the world except what had occurred in bed with you, and change her into something she'd never been, and didn't seem to want to become. "Is this what I've wound up with?" I asked melodramatically as I cried. "A terrible, ugly little room with dead flies?" "No, no, it's just temporary, Joni," Joe said. But he too was worried that he'd made some kind of irrevocably bad choice. Really, though, it hadn't been much of a choice. After she'd flung the walnut, Carol Castleman had thrown her husband out of their house, and he understood that even if he didn't resign from the English department at Smith, he would be dismissed. So now he was ruined academically and financially. But as for me, when I walked out of Northrop House, it was with a strange combination of disgrace and power. I'd told Joe how my friend Laura Sonnengard and other girls had lined up in their nightgowns to say goodbye to me, like orphans in a Shirley Temple movie, and that they were tearful and deeply impressed, knowing that I was going off to a life that was likely to be more compelling than theirs, at least in the short run. "You say it's only temporary, but life is temporary," I said to him. "So you're not really making me feel any better." I knew I was pathetic, sitting there on the hotel bed with my lump and my insistently girlish clothes. "It's not my job to make you feel better," he told me. "And don't give me your freshman year philosophy. If you don't want to be here, then please go. Get back on that bus and go back up to Smith. I'm sure they'll take you back. They'd be too scared of the legal end not to. The oversexed Jewish professor who raped the lovely young debutante." "I am not a debutante," I said. "And screw you, Joe. You never raped me. I made up my own mind. I knew what I wanted to do." This seemed to startle him. "You did?" he said, sitting down next to me. "I thought it was all me, kissing you in my office, setting things in motion." "No. I felt it that first day of class," I said. "When you walked into Seeley Hall and you were such a mess and your wife had just had a baby and you read aloud from the dead, every girl in that class wanted to have some kind of relationship with you." "Oh," he said, pleased. I didn't know that. Well, it's true. I love you, Joni, you know, he told me, and I thought that maybe he actually did. This conversation calmed me for a while, and soon I agreed to go out with him into the spring night, into the chatter and drifting music of the village. Joe took me to supper at the Grand Ticino, where I ate a bowl of spaghetti al burro, the only dish I ever ordered back then in Italian restaurants, much to his irritation. And Joe ate brains. The hour was late, but the place was still packed, which was so different from Northampton, where restaurants closed early. Joe talked about nights spent on Bancroft Road, pacing the rooms of his depressing house, fetching Carol the A&D ointment, watching her slick the rancid orange jelly onto the baby's bottom. I am so glad to be away from there, he said as he ate his plate of brains. I thought I would die in that house. So thank you. Thank you for rescuing me from a life like that, even if it was unexpected. Ah, don't mention it, I said, and he held my hand across the table. You got butter on your lips, Joe told me. They're shining. I think you must be a saint. Saint Joan. Soon we began to talk of other things until, toward the end of dinner, he admitted that he didn't only feel relief at having left Carol and Fanny. He also felt a kind of sorrow. He spoke in a breaking voice of holding his baby girl and touching the soft place on her head, the fontanelle where the bones hadn't yet joined fully. I'll help you, I said automatically. You can't help me. I couldn't understand the loss a young father felt, he insisted. But weirdly, I seemed to be able to. Both of us had conjured up the image of the abandoned baby, the little girl he had named after the literary Fanny Price. In a few weeks, Joe would write his wife a calm and repentant letter. Actually, he would outline the general ideas he wanted to convey, and I would put them into words. The letter would be moving and earnest, but not overly sentimental. And in it he'd sketch out the beginnings of an alimony and child support plan that he'd discussed with his lawyer friend Ned, and he'd request that he be allowed to visit the baby every month, inhaling her with the urgency of a father who no longer lives at home. I did help him in my own limited way. I stayed with him for weeks in the Waverly Arms, and we relied on sex to cut a swath through the days that kept appearing before us. I washed my underpants and hose in the little stained sink in our room, and when they dried they were stiff from the brown bar of soap I'd used. The toilet in the hall had a weak flushing mechanism, and other tenants left urine and toilet paper in the bowl, a glutinous puddle that reminded me of the egg drop soup we ate in Chinatown. Sometimes Joe and I walked the streets for hours, stopping to sit and kiss on the stoops of buildings as we'd seen others do. Mostly, though, we stayed in, and I knew that we'd eventually turn on each other if we were trapped inside that tiny room all day. He wasn't about to leave, though. He was a writer, or he was going to be one, and he needed to be there to write. He had some savings that would go towards supporting Carol and the baby, at least for a while. I didn't have the same fever to write that he did. At Smith he'd encouraged me, but now that we were in New York, we talked only of his writing, and I didn't mind. I didn't think I had too much to say, and even if I had, Elaine Moselle had assured me of the futility of saying it. Joe was the one who would work on short stories while I'd go out and make some money, supplementing the small income I had from my grandmother. So I made a few telephone calls, using the skein of connections I'd made growing up in the city, remembering that Candy Mullington from Brearley's mother was head of personnel at the publishing house Bower and Leeds. Mrs. Mullington agreed to see me, and I was given a job as the assistant to an editor, Hal Wellman. Joe was thrilled. He loved that I had something useful to do, and that I would actually be working in publishing, that I'd be around books all day, and editors and potential contacts for him for the future, when he had a novel to sell. Bower and Leeds was located on the 9th floor of a medium-sized limestone building on Madison Avenue and 46th Street, and I took the train up to Grand Central every morning, while Joe slept in. He admitted that he liked waking up just long enough to see me pull off my nightgown. Every day he noticed that I looked exactly the same as I had the day before. Time hid itself from you, or at least gravity did. The world in which I now spent my days was mysterious to Joe. He was grateful that he didn't have to be there too, but he wished he could invade it anyway, to watch me as I sat in my cubicle and answered the telephone for the cordial, overworked, and red-faced Mr. Wellman. "What's he like?" Joe asked. "Mr. Wellman? Oh, he's a prince. He talks to me about everyone there. Actually lets me in on things. He treats me as if I'm more than an assistant, and he lets me handle the slush pile."
"Lucky you," said Joe.
"There's nothing wrong with the slush pile," I said, "except for its quality. Anyway, someone has to read it." At night, I brought home bagfuls of manuscripts. Together we sat in our hotel bed and amused ourselves over how bad they were. "Listen to this," I would say to him. "It's a novel called Courage Be My Guide, and it opens like this. Chester McKay had been looking in pool rooms and gin mills for happiness, until one day he realized it damn sure couldn't be bought." The ludicrous writing fortified both of us. It was a yardstick by which to measure ourselves. We read other people's sad attempts, and we acted as though we were both far beyond them, although the ghost of Joe's story, No Milk on Sunday, still hovered. But that story must have been an aberration. Why else would he feel so confident that the slush pile at B&L was filled with such unmitigated shit? He could separate the good from the bad. He understood the difference. His own work would grow, would get better with time. He had been very young when he wrote that story. He didn't really know what he was doing then, and now he was starting to. One night we went to a party at the home of Joe's old friend Harry Jacklin and his wife Maria, who lived in a walk-up on Grove Street. When we arrived, people lined the stairway, a powerful blast of reefer smoke drifting down. Joe led me protectively through the crowd, saying hello to old friends from Columbia and from the brief period of his life that he'd spent in New York with Carol. People were surprised to see him there, and of course even more surprised to see me with him, I could tell, and he had to quickly explain the situation, trying to make it all seem arch and humorous. "I traded up," he said to someone, or, "I got myself a newer model, runs more smoothly, doesn't throw things." It became clear that no one had particularly liked Carol, though they hadn't had the courage to tell him before, and felt great relief that now the truth could come out. Joe ached for a drink of some kind, something clear and powerful to set him right. Soon he was drinking vodka and pulling on a joint, handed to him by a thin black homosexual named Digby, a dancer who'd been asked to join Martha Graham's troupe, someone whispered. With the eerie strains of theremin music on the record player, Digby was holding court in one corner of the apartment, sitting on the radiator surrounded by young white women and talking about Negro rights. The women looked up at Digby with worshipful, half-shut eyes, as though he were Paul Robeson at a communist rally. What did these girls know of Negro rights? Not much more than I did, I imagined. They were strictly Sarah Lawrence or Bennington types. I could picture them dancing in togas in a field of flowers, and suddenly I wished I was dancing with them, feeling the mush of earth underfoot, having no attachment to a man, no terrible bed to sleep in, just being part of a chain of girls in a field. These thoughts were the result of the reefer stirring things up in me, I thought. And then I was even more certain, because within 15 minutes, I was doing an interpretive dance to an Ima Sumac record in the hallway, and from across the room I saw Joe watch me with pride and admiration that together resembled ownership, though of course I'd asked for it. I'd wanted it, putting myself directly in the line of his vision up in the landscape of Smith College. Later, when the party settled down with quieter music and the dancing stopped, a few of the men went out onto the fire escape to talk, and Joe grabbed me to go with them. Lyle Samuelson, who taught linguistics at City College, lined up a row of spent beer bottles on the windowsill and knocked the first one against the second, which sent the third one down, though none of them broke, just rolled.
"Look, remember Ike Domino's theory?" Samuelson said.
There goes Cambodia and Thailand and whoops, what the hell? There goes Japan. Then he called out into the room to no one in particular. We need some more beers here. Distantly, a woman's voice called back. Coming right up. I didn't know these men, and though I was happy just to lean against Joe and listen to them talk, for their voices were deep and knowledgeable, even if what they said wasn't particularly. Suddenly another one of them appeared, and I realized he was someone from B&L. Bob Lovejoy, a baby-faced editor who never talked to any of the assistants, never said hello, always looked uncommonly busy and imperious, although he had only been out of college himself a couple of years. Lovejoy turned suddenly, and though it wouldn't have occurred to me that he'd know who I was, he said in a flat, odd voice,
Joan, Joan, the piper's son, stole two pigs and away she run.
Then he added, Why'd you steal those pigs, Joan? The other men laughed vaguely, Joe included, though it wasn't witty. What I felt primarily was the hostility in Bob Lovejoy, inexplicably directed toward me. What was I doing here, he was wondering, when I was only some editorial assistant? What was a pencil sharpener, a paper filer, a reader at the slush pile doing here on this fire escape with the men? She didn't steal anything, Joe said. She's completely scrupulous, this girl. I trust her with my life. And anyway, Lovejoy, she's extremely quick. A very fine writer of the short story.
Well, that's wonderful, said Bob Lovejoy. We need more lady writers, though I hate to admit there are a few pretty good ones out there these days.
He hated to admit it. And he was happy to admit he hated it. Lovejoy dutifully mentioned a few women whose work was taken seriously, an imposing political playwright with the face of a sea turtle, a poet prone to sudden fits of self-promotion that involved giving impromptu readings of her own work at other people's book parties, and a novelist who catalogued small-town goings-on with tattletale vigor. The novelist had the creepy demeanor of one of the children from The Turn of the Screw, and seemed to be a future suicide if there ever was one. If I'd tried, I could have rattled off my own roll call of important women writers. Mary McCarthy always came to mind right away, with her extraordinary prose, her architectural cheekbones, her hair pulled back off an extra-long mannerist neck, and her various public connections to high-wattage men. That last part seemed to be essential. Without those connections, she would have been too free, too exotic, less compelling. I knew that she was impressive and beautiful and scary. It would be difficult for a man to find a way to mock her, and so I assumed that few did. Instead, they admired her. They thought she was one of a kind. They were either silent in her presence or nervously chatty and needing to rise to the occasion. It was as though she existed in order to defy all expectations and to deflect the arrows of the men who were shaken by the simple fact that she did exist. And oh God, was she tough. She would have to be, taking on politics and art, chewing on them like twisty bits of rawhide. She and one or two other lesser female literary lights had a demeanor that lit a fire beneath their brilliance and gave it style, allowing them to slip through the swinging doors that were clearly etched with the word men. But what happened to the talented women who lacked sharp cheekbones or an ease in the universe? The ones who had no attachments to powerful men?
Women writers, even if they don't necessarily take the world by storm, they certainly make life a little brighter, Samuelson was saying. At least the tolerable ones do anyway.
Have you ever noticed, said Lovejoy slowly, as though introducing a theory he'd been quietly cultivating for some time, that a surprisingly high number of them are mad as hatters?
We drive them to it, said Joe. That must be the reason.
Yeah, we push them to the brink, said Lovejoy cheerfully. Wouldn't you say so, Joan?
They all looked toward me expectantly, as though I spoke for all women and their potential for mental illness. I have no idea, I said.
I've come across a few of that kind in my day, said Samuelson. Boy, they give you a run for your money.
The men all nodded and laughed easily, Joe included, though. When he saw me looking at him, he sobered quickly.
"You're not one of them, are you?" Lovejoy said to me mildly.
He leaned forward, reached out, and then very, very lightly stroked the soft skin of my forearm with his fingers. I jerked back quickly. "Don't," I said. Lovejoy removed his hand.
"Sorry," he said, and then he shrugged at Joe. "It was just irresistible."
"Like women themselves," said Lyle Samuelson.
"Like women themselves," repeated Lovejoy.
"Hey, Bob," said Joe in a vague and muzzled voice. "Did you see the sign? No touching." I knew then that Joe had been made aware for the first time what it might feel like to sit outnumbered among the mutterings of men. It was as though he'd been given a rare glimpse into what a woman felt and thought. He had opinions, of course, the typical ones of the day concerning communism and race relations and Dien Bien Phu, but when it came to the landscape of women, he was at a loss to say much of anything. The men kept chuckling and nodding together, while I sat uncomfortably among them. Bob Lovejoy had touched my arm, and I'd felt pillaged, interfered with, and hadn't known how to respond aggressively. Men touched women unbidden, and the women murmured don't, or shouted it out, or pulled away, and either the men stopped what they were doing, or didn't stop. It was the way of the world. I was here with Joe, and I couldn't just get up and leave. I leaned against the railing of the fire escape and peered down miserably over the quiet street. Joe looped an arm around my bare shoulder, which was cold, in need of covering.
"Listen, you,"
he whispered into the whirl of an ear that poked out from under my hair. "Let's get out of here." And I was grateful. Too grateful. As though he were saving me. And we extricated ourselves and left the party, walking together through the village after midnight, leaning into each other once in a while to kiss, as if in mutual apology, stopping beneath a street lamp at Sheridan Square, where a newsstand was still open, the final edition of the Herald pinned up like laundry. Below us, a passing subway train sent up a blast of warm air. We smelled urine and peanuts as though a circus train were rushing by beneath us, and we wished we could get on. One Sunday morning upon awakening, Joe told me he had to begin writing a novel. "No offense, Joni," he said, pulling himself from the bed surprisingly early, "but I have to get up. I'm going to start writing a book. No more stories. They'll get me nowhere." He sat in boxer shorts at the writing desk with his little royal typewriter in front of him. He smoked and drank some Coke from a glass that until a few minutes earlier had held our toothbrushes. The walnuts were gone. Since the incident with Carol, he'd lost his taste for them, and he never did regain it. I stayed in bed enjoying the novelty for a while of watching him write, but finally I got bored and said I had to go out. It was my parents' apartment I went to, the first time I'd been there since I'd left Smith. I was scared, but decided I was bigger than they were. I had Joe on my side. As I'd assumed, they had in fact been appalled when Smith informed them that I'd dropped out. An irate, typed letter addressed to me on my father's letterhead had arrived at the hotel after they'd tracked me down. The letter called me a disappointment, and it was signed, "From your mother and father," with no mention or even whiff of love. Which is why it was odd that I was choosing to go there now. But the Waverly Arms was so depressing, and Joe, in his new determined novelist mode, was drawing up into himself like a fetus. Laura Sonnengard and the rest of my friends were off at college. Right now they were studying, smooching with boyfriends, getting dressed in pristine sweaters and sensible shoes. I needed to get away from the grime of the room for a while and the silent, heavy presence of Joe. Reflexively, I thought I needed my parents, despite everything, and so I went there. Ray, the day doorman at my parents' building, didn't know of my disgrace, for he tipped his hat and asked me how it felt to be a co-ed. And Gus, the elevator man, pulled the brass lever as we rode slowly upward, and he told me about his son, off at New Jersey Technical College, where he was studying refrigeration systems. Then I was right there in the vestibule outside the apartment I'd grown up in, with the umbrella stand and the wicker chair that had never been blessed with the pressure of a human posterior. I let myself in and stood in the front hall, calling out tentatively, "Hello? Hello?" My mother, in an aqua satin robe, appeared, and when she saw it was me, she burst out crying, a surprisingly unrestrained bleat that made me want to run. I couldn't comfort her. What could I possibly say? So we sat down in the pale living room with its low white couches and pastels of New York streets in the rain, and I watched her cry for a while. Finally, she blew her nose in a handkerchief and then looked at me sharply. "Your father is out playing golf with the Dorlings. We know that this isn't the end of the world," she told me.
"Good," I said.
"But when the college told us this man was a Jew..."
"They told you that?"
"Yes," said my mother. "We asked them. He's a Jew and he's married, and somehow he's convinced you that this is love." Now she stood up from her couch and came over to mine. Each of the couches was long and sleek, an individual ocean liner. "Believe me, Joan, I know how it is. They're very persuasive," she went on. "There was a man here once, a Mr. Milton Fish. He came to talk to your father about investing in his company. Something about textiles. I'll never forget what he wore. It was a striped suit. And by the end of the evening, your poor father was practically eating out of this Mr. Milton Fish's hand, practically signing an enormous check to him that basically would have bankrupted our family forever. It was only when I called your father into the bedroom and gave him a talking to that he came around, that he saw he was under this salesman's spell, which is exactly what's happening with you and your professor. The powers of persuasion. They speak well. They pride themselves on their history of education, as they like to say, and they know how to use words with plenty of syllables, and they're dark and mysterious, so that you feel as though you've entered a gypsy den. And how much more thrilling that must feel than being with the kind of boys you're used to, like Alec Mears or the Bexley's son. Am I right?" Her words were so rapid and wild that I began to blink like someone under a strobe light. "Am I right?" my mother was saying. "You have been with other boys, Joan." "No, I mean, have you been with them in a carnal way as man and woman? Because if you have, then probably you're choosing your professor for his skills in that department. They aren't afraid of sex. Not them. They want to do it constantly, even when the woman has her menses, and they..." "Mother, are you completely off the wall?" I leaped up. "I came here because I was lonely and Joe was working," I told her. "He's Jewish, yes, and so what if he wants sex all the time? I do, too." She blinked several times in response to this. "But he's a talented writer, okay? A good writer. And he's going to become famous, and won't it make a difference how you feel about him then?" "Not one iota," said my mother, her jaw as tight as the curls on her head that had been plastered there very recently. I could still smell the carnation odor of beauty parlor, could conjure the metal combs floating like specimens in blue water. It was as though, having read Joe's poor story in Caryatid, I needed to defend his honor more fervently than ever. If I didn't, who would? His wife Carol hated him, and Fanny might soon be taught to hate him too. His fledgling attempts at fiction weren't anything to write home about, and yet here I was, shouting compliments about Joe through the mayonnaise-colored living room of my childhood, and hoping I would start to believe them. He was talented, wasn't he? He looked talented anyway. He was brooding and unpredictable and bridling with sensations I didn't understand, sensations that I dubbed male. Male and solid and influential, the emotions of men at war, or men hunched around the smoking powwow of a poker game. I would tell everyone he was talented, and then he would rise to the occasion. "So you won't meet him?" I asked my mother. Oh, really? What do you think, Joan? She said. And it was true that the prospect of a sit-down with Joe and my parents was horrible, no matter how you looked at it. He would see two skeletons clutching highballs. They would see a fast-talking garment salesman with a penis as